happy families. At one of those times when I wanted to be writing a story but didn't have one to write, I got to thinking again about the opening words of Anna Karenina, which are so often quoted as if they were true, and decided the time had come to write down my thoughts, since I had nothing better to do. They were published, after a while, in the Michigan Quarterly Review. I used to be too respectful to disagree with Tolstoy, but after I got into my 60s, my faculty of respect atrophied. Besides, at some point in the last 40 years, I began to question Tolstoy's respect for his wife. Anybody can make a mistake in marriage, of course, but I have an impression that no matter whom he married, Tolstoy would have respected her only in certain respects, though he expected her to respect him in all respects. In this respect, I disapprove of Tolstoy, which makes it easier to disagree with him in the first place, and in the second place, to say so. There has been a long gap between the first and second places, years. But there was a period of as many years even before the first place, before I achieved the point of disagreement, the ability to disapprove. During all those years, from when I was 14 or so and first read him till I was in my 40s, I was, as it were, married to Tolstoy, his loyal wife. Though fortunately not expected to copy his manuscripts 6 times over by hand, I read and reread his books with joy and zeal. I respected him without ever asking if or wondering whether he, as it were, respected me. When E.M. Forster, in an essay on Tolstoy, told me that he didn't, I replied, "He has that right." And if E.M. Forster had asked, "What gives him that right?" I would have answered simply, "Genius." But E.M. Forster didn't ask, which is just as well, since he probably would have asked what I meant by genius. I think what I meant by genius was that I thought Tolstoy actually knew what he was talking about, unlike the rest of us. However, at some point, around 40 or so, I began to wonder if he really knew what he was talking about any better than anybody else, or if what he knew better than anybody else was how to talk about it. The two things are easily confused. So then, quietly, in my private mind, surrounded by the soft, supportive mutterings of feminists, I began to ask rude questions of Tolstoy. In public, I remained a loyal and loving wife, entirely respectful of his opinions as well as his art. But the unspoken questions were there, the silent disagreement. And the unspoken, as we know, tends to strengthen, to mature and grow richer over the years like an undrunk wine. Of course, it may just go to Freudian vinegar. Some thoughts and feelings go to vinegar very quickly and must be poured out at once. Some go on fermenting in the bottle and burst out in an explosion of murderous glass shards. But a good, robust, well-corked feeling only gets deeper and more complicated down in the cellar. The thing is knowing when to uncork it. It's ready. I'm ready. The great first sentence of the first chapter of the great book, not the greatest book, but perhaps the second greatest, is, yes, we can say it in unison, "All happy families are alike. Unhappy families are each unhappy in their own way." Translations vary, but not significantly. People quote that sentence so often that it must satisfy them, but it does not. It never quite did satisfy me. And 20 years ago or so, I began admitting my dissatisfaction to myself. These happy families he speaks of so confidently in order to dismiss them as all alike, where are they? Were they very much commoner in the 19th century? Did he know numerous happy families among the Russian nobility, or middle class, or peasantry, all of them alike? This seems so unlikely that I wondered if perhaps he knew a few happy families, which is not impossible, but that those few were all alike seems deeply, very deeply implausible. Was his own family happy, either the one he grew up in or the one he fathered? Did he know one family, one single family that could, over a substantial period of time, as a whole and in each of its component members, honestly be called happy? If he did, He knew one more than most of us do. I'm not just showing off my sexagenarian cynicism, proud though I may be of it. I admit that a family can be happy in the sense that almost all the members of it are in good health, good spirits, and good temper with one another for quite a long time. A week, a month, even longer. And if we go into the comparative mode, then certainly some families are far happier than others, on the whole and for years on end, because there are so many extremely unhappy families. Many people I have talked with about such matters were in one way or another unhappy as children, and perhaps most people, though they stayed deeply attached to their relatives and recall joyous times with them, would not describe their family as happy. We had some real good times, they say. I grew up in a family that, on the whole, seems to have been happier than most families, and yet I find it false, an intolerable cheapening of reality, simply to describe it as happy. The enormous cost and complexity of that happiness, its dependence upon a whole substructure of sacrifices, repressions, suppressions, choices made or foregone, chances taken or lost, balancings of greater and lesser evils, the tears, the fears, the migraines, the injustices, the censorships, the quarrels, the lies, the angers, the cruelties it involved. Is all that to be swept away, brushed under the carpet by the brisk broom of a silly phrase, a happy family? And why? In order to imply that happiness is easy, shallow, ordinary? A common thing not worth writing a novel about, whereas unhappiness is complex, deep, difficult to attain, unusual, unique indeed, and so a worthy subject for a great, a unique novelist? Surely that is a silly idea. But silly or not, it has been imposingly influential among novelists and critics for decades. Many a novelist would wither in shame if the reviewers caught him writing about happy people, families like other families, people like other people. And indeed, many critics are keenly on the watch for happiness in novels in order to dismiss it as banal, sentimental, or, in other words, for women. How the whole thing got gendered, I don't know, but it did. The gendering supposes that male readers have strong, tough, reality-craving natures, while feeble female readers crave constant reassurance in the form of little warm blobs of happiness, fuzzy bunnies. This is true of some women. Some women have never experienced any glimpse of happiness in their whole life better than a stuffed fuzzy bunny, and so they surround themselves with stuffed fuzzy bunnies, fictional or actual. In this, they may be luckier than most men who aren't allowed stuffed fuzzy bunnies. Only girls in bunny suits. In any case, who can blame them, the men or the women? Not me. Anybody who has been privileged to know real, solid, non-fuzzy happiness, and then lets some novelist or critic buffalo them into believing that they shouldn't read about it because it's commoner than unhappiness, inferior to unhappiness, less interesting than unhappiness, where does my syntax lead me? Into judgmentalism. I shall extricate myself in silence. The falseness of Tolstoy's famous sentence is nowhere shown more clearly than in Tolstoy's novels, including the one it's the first sentence of. Dolly's family, which is the unhappy one we are promised, is, in my opinion, a moderately, that is to say, a realistically happy one. Dolly and her children are kind and contented, often merry together, and the husband and wife definitely have their moments for all his stupid skirt-chasing. In the greater novel, the Rostovs, when we meet them, might well be described as a happy family, rich, healthy, generous, kind, full of passions and counter-passions, full of vitality, energy, and love. But the Rostovs are not like anybody. They are idiosyncratic, unpredictable, incomparable. And, like most human beings, they can't hang on to their happiness. The old count wastes his children's heritage, and the countess worries herself sick. Moscow burns, Natasha falls in love with a cold fish, nearly runs away with a cretin, marries, and turns into a mindless brood sow. Petya is killed pointlessly in the war at 16. Jolly good fun, fuzzy bunnies everywhere. Tolstoy knew what happiness is, how rare, how imperiled, how hard won. Not only that, he had the ability to describe happiness, a rare gift, which gives his novels much of their extraordinary beauty. Why he denied his knowledge in the famous sentence, I don't know. He did a good deal of lying and denying, perhaps more than many lesser novelists do. He had more to lie about, and his cruel theoretical Christianity led him into all kinds of denials of what in his fiction he saw and showed to be true. So maybe he was just showing off. It sounded good. It made a great first sentence. My next essay will be about whether or not I want to be told to call a stranger Ishmael.